Okay. So tonight's topic is education funding. Now, in education funding, you'll see some time value applications. We'll talk about those time value applications tomorrow after we go through some of the time value of money calculations. Tonight, what I want to do is just talk about this process in concept and talk about some of the tools and techniques that you have available to help fund educational needs. When you look at financial needs, if you look at that three-panel approach that we went through last time, remember that usually the first thing we're going to do is cover risks. And then we tend to cover short-term needs. We need to have an emergency fund to make sure that everything else is going to work. But then once that's done, we can look at accumulation objectives. And probably the most common accumulation objectives that people are going to have are going to be buying the house, saving for kids' education, helping kids get through college, if that's their goal. Not everybody has that as a goal, but for those that have it as a goal, that requires a substantial amount of capital. And then third, retirement funding. And then once you're finished with that, then you can focus more on the legacy type planning or the estate planning. But until we get all of those things under our belt, usually people aren't going to be thinking too much about that long-term estate planning or gift tax planning approach that you'll talk about in the last class in this course. So this is one of those areas that tends to be a common objective with people. Now, if you look at some of the issues that you face in this area, the educational consumer price index, if you want to talk about that, educational inflation is running about 6% a year, whereas the long-run average CPI is about 2.5% a year. So educational costs are going up faster than normal inflation, and there are lots of reasons for that. One of those was a demographic issue. As the baby boomers and then the reciprocal baby boom pushed through the educational system, there was a lot of demand for education, for seats at colleges and universities. And because of that demand, the colleges ramped up their programs, hired more staff, hired more faculty, expanded programs, and so on. And that costs money. So that's one of the reasons for it. The other reason is that over time, the government has cut back a little bit on some of the funding. In the past, a lot of people used to have more access to government funding for this, and now a lot of this has been shifted more toward the private sector. So the educational inflation rate is going to become important. When we do projections and we look at time value issues, you're going to have to factor that in, the difference between the actual inflation rate and the educational inflation rate, to be able to get to the right accumulation you need to fully fund that education need when the children reach age 18. Also, if you look at trends that have been occurring in the college environment, I see this daily. This is what I do on a day-to-day basis, but students are tending to stay in college longer. Not only because some degree programs are longer. When I went to college, just about every degree program, except for perhaps pharmacy, was a four-year degree. Now engineering degrees tend to be 5 years, and certain science degrees are a little bit longer. And so the degree requirements have increased, that's one thing. But secondly, a lot of times students are exploring a little bit more in the earlier years of college and may need to spend a little bit more time to catch up once they figure out what they really want to do. So in reality, people are spending a little more time in college than they were before, and you might want to factor that into your projections. Well, there have been cutbacks in things like public education, the state universities and the state schools. If you look at the costs of going to state school, those have increased substantially over the last, say, 20 years because the state governments primarily have pulled back funding on that. So the tuition costs have gone up quite a bit. And those are still lower than private universities, the education costs for private universities, but you've seen more of an increase in that arena. For example, when I was in college, going to University of Connecticut was not all that expensive. It was a couple thousand dollars a semester. Now it's about $25,000 a year to go to a public school. So it's getting the public schools are coming close now to some of the private school costs. Now some of the private schools are costing now $45,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, depending on where you go, as well. But you have that. And then secondly, for a while, there was a bit of a cutback on some of the financial aid that was provided at the federal level. And to a certain extent, the government offset that by providing educational incentives in the form of tax credits and other tax advantage savings opportunities like 529 plans and the now it's called the American Opportunity Credit, which we'll go over this tonight. We'll cover all of these tonight. But they've shifted a little bit of the focus more toward the private side. They want to encourage people to fund this as opposed to rely on governmental sources for funding. Okay. So the kids are staying in college longer, and what issues do we want to consider? Time is crucial. Now, since this weekend deals with time value, and you all know how this works, I'm sure you all know the basics of time value. You've all done some calculations figuring out what your retirement fund will be worth when you retire, whether or not you have enough money in the fund, how much you have to put in, those kinds of things. Why do we want to consider time? Because the more time we have, the easier it is to save the lump sum or the amount that we're going to need so that we have the lump sum available to pay for college costs when the children get to college age. The inflation will continue to drive those costs. Now, this may reverse a little bit. This educational inflation rate could very well reverse going forward because now that the reciprocal baby boom has gone through college, there are actually more seats available in colleges than there are applicants to colleges now. So colleges are going to have to compete a little bit in the next several years, maybe the next 10, 15 years or so before we see an uptick in the population again. So that could actually slow the increase in the cost or may, on the other side of the house, increase financial aid opportunities either provided by the college or by private sources. So what you expect to happen might impact your ultimate financial funding decisions, but this is something that you have to sit down and talk with the client. Obviously, if clients want to be more conservative, we probably want to assume there's going to be a little bit higher inflation rate than we expect would actually occur. If they want to be a little bit more aggressive, then we can take a lower rate. And also, there are lots of different types of tuition. Most of the time when we talk about funding education, what we're talking about is funding the college costs. That's what most people think of as the educational costs. That's not all though, because in many families, a lot of families want to send their kids to private elementary schools, private junior high schools, prep schools, because sending them to those schools gets them access to networks that they wouldn't otherwise have, and sometimes gets them an upper hand in getting into some of the more prestigious universities across the country. So paying for those kinds of costs sometimes pays off in the form of being able to get into the better universities. Of course, if you get into those better universities, you better have a lot of money sitting on the side to pay for them because they're not cheap. So you've got to factor all that in. But in some families, you will have the children going to private school all the way through their schooling process, and that should be considered as well.
Can you use a 529?
No. 529 is only for post-secondary education. It doesn't have to be college with a 529. You could send a child to a professional school. Actually, you could use a 529 to fund this type of program because it's a professional certification program on a post-secondary basis. So that would count. But you could use something called a covered L education savings account, which I'll talk about a little bit later. It's not as good because, well, I shouldn't say it's not as good. It provides many of the same benefits that a 529 plan does, but the cap on the contributions is so low that you really can't accumulate lots of money in short periods of time to make it a very attractive feature. But no, 529s can't be used for that purpose. There are better ways, though, for funding this. If you're talking about families that are going to pay for elementary or secondary school as well, chances are those are wealthier families. There might be intergenerational wealth in those families. And when you get to estate planning, you'll talk about something called qualified transfers. And a qualified transfer is the payment of educational expenses directly to a college or the payment of medical expenses directly to a medical provider. When you make those kinds of payments, those aren't considered gifts. So you have no gift tax consequence when, for example, grandma or grandpa pay the college education costs or the elementary or secondary education costs of the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren, there's no gift and it gets it immediately out of the grandparents' estate. So in a sense, if the grandparent died right away, assuming we go back in 2011 to the old rules, you could have a tax of up to 55%, maybe 60% if you're in the surtax bracket. So if grandma and grandpa pay for that, they're only paying, it's only costing them about 40 to 50 cents on the dollar to pay those education costs, plus you're leaving the parents of the perceived obligation to help fund the children's education. So it's almost like an indirect gift to the parents. At the same time, it's a direct gift to the grandchildren because their tuition's covered. Does everybody see that? Make sense? So when we're looking at those higher net worth families, and those are probably the ones that are going to be looking at that type of educational funding, elementary and secondary, chances are we're going to have wealth at a senior generation level that can be used to pay for those costs directly. And that may be a preferable way of doing it.
Is there any data available about what percentage of grandparents are paying for college education and high school education?
Not that I'm aware of. There are no surveys that collect that data. There are several surveys that follow cohorts of people through various life cycles, like the Survey of Consumer Finances and so on, that are sponsored by the government, but they don't ask about that. They tend to focus just on the financial affairs of that one group. So they don't often ask, or they don't ask very many questions that deal with those intergenerational type wealth transfers or what's happening. So unfortunately, we don't have that data. I can tell you from personal experience, though, that the higher the net worth of the family group, the more likely that is to happen. You'll see because the grandparents have an incentive to reduce their estate, to reduce exposure to estate tax, and usually they also want to create human capital by getting the grandchildren through the right schools and getting them with the right credentials so that they can make money. When we talk about capital, and we miss this sometimes in financial planning, we usually focus just on the financial capital. How do we generate enough money to do this thing that we want to do or to achieve this financial objective? When you move to the higher net worth planning, capital is not just money. It also involves human capital, which is the ability of the heirs to make money themselves going forward. There's social capital issues, which oftentimes involves charity. All of these things are valuable and need to be factored into an overall plan if you're going to do the plan well for clients at that level. So you can almost think of that like the grandparents making an investment in the human capital of the family. And they do it on a tax advantage basis because if we get out of paying gift tax and estate tax on those transfers. Really neat tool. Okay, so just consider those various issues. That has to be factored into any plan if it's a goal or objective of the client. Now, for a lot of families aren't going to be able to accumulate enough money or just happen to have enough money around to pay the full bill for college education for their kids. One way they can potentially get some supplemental help is through financial aid. And the way they do that is they fill out this FAFSA form. And it used to be paper and pencil. Now it's online. You go to fafsa.ed.gov, and you can actually fill this thing out online. And you put information in about the age of the student, what their income is, what the parents' income is, how many children are in the household, what kind of medical costs the family incurs. There are all kinds of questions that are asked because that information is going to be used by the government. They're going to put it through an algorithm to figure out something called the expected family contribution, or the EFC, which is what we should expect the family to be able to provide to pay for the education costs of that child. And once that's figured out, once we've determined the expected family contribution, we can subtract that from the cost of tuition at the school that the child's going to go to, and the difference between those two numbers equals the financial need. So if it costs, for example, $45,000 to go to the college that you want your child to go to, and your expected family contribution is $15,000, you have a financial need of $30,000. So we're going to have to fund that $30,000 in some way. That could come through a combination of loans, through work-study programs. There are all different ways that we can get additional funding to pay for it, but that's going to set the limit on the amount of financial aid you can get. Now, another thing I want to point out with this, and this is important, is that the financial need depends on the institution you go to. So if, let me change the facts, that $45,000 tuition cost might have been for a private university, right? You put it, all the information in the FAFSA, and then you find out your expected family contribution is $15,000, and you send your kid to a state school where the tuition is $20,000. What's the financial need now? It's only $5,000. So the financial need's going to change based on the tuition charged by the institution that the child goes to, but the expected family contribution doesn't change. So the amount of financial aid you'll be able to get is going to be much lower going to that school that charges $20,000 in tuition compared to the school that's going to charge $45,000 in tuition. Does that make sense? See how all that works? It's kind of logical. Now, there are ways of reducing that expected family contribution, and many of the ways involve things like making assets disappear or not accumulating assets in the names of the parent or the child. The problem with those kinds of approaches, though, is that if you're going to do that, you're planning for what? Planning for failure, right? A lot of people you'll get a lot of people that'll come to you as clients, and they'll say, what can I do to make sure I qualify for financial aid for my kid to go to school? My response is usually, well, let's see what we can do to make sure your kid doesn't need to qualify for financial aid to go to school. And then if there's a shortfall, we'll worry about it. But we don't want to plan to fail. We don't want to plan to not have the money or not have the funding. We want to plan to succeed. So if we do the right things over time, maybe we don't have to rely on this as much. And that gives you more choices, which is a good thing. So you can do things like move assets out of the parent's name or move assets out of the child's name. If you give a lot of assets to the kids, or grandma and grandpa are very generous, and they give big gifts to the grandkids, that's going to be factored into that expected family contribution, because that's money that's available to pay for the children's education. If grandma and grandpa keep the money, then that's not included. And grandma and grandpa, remember, can do what? They can just pay the tuition bill when the kids get ready to go to school, but there's a risk here too, because if grandma and grandpa die before the kids go to school, now they have all that money in their estate and they paid more taxes and there might not be as much to pay for those education. So there are always risks. No matter what you do, there are always going to be risks. Another thing you can do too, it would be to keep funds separate. Now, if you're looking at more of an intergenerational wealth planning situation, you might not want to transfer lots of assets into the names of the family members that have younger children. Because by doing those are parental assets, those are available for paying college costs, and they're going to be factored into that expected family contribution. So if we keep them aside in a separate arrangement where nobody's really entitled to those assets directly, you set up perhaps a family education trust, and it's a discretionary trust that can pay out benefits to cover costs for school or education, that won't be included in this calculation.
How is home equity factored?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how the formula works, but the asset value, the net worth of the family, is going to be a factor of that expected contribution. Because if you have home equity, one of the ways you can pay for college would be to get a home equity loan and use that to pay for the college costs. So that will be factored in. I don't know exactly how it works, though. Okay, everybody got the gist of?
What happens if family doesn't want to pay for any sort of education because they feel it's a child's responsibility?
Okay, well, if the child is independent, now to be independent for this purpose, for educational funding purposes, the kid has to be over age 23 or married or be enrolled in a master's or doctoral program, have legal dependents other than a spouse, be an orphan or ward of the court, or be a veteran. If they meet any of those requirements, they could be considered independent and not a dependent of the parents for tax purposes, and then their income stands alone. We don't have to include the income of the parents in that determination. But until the child's age 23, most kids are not going to fit these categories. Right? You're not going to see too many, especially these days. People get married later. Unless you have a child prodigy, they're not going to be in their PhD program at age 20. So they're going to be looking at undergraduate programs and so on. Most children are going to be in that in that category where the parent's income is going to be considered. And that will affect their ability to get financial aid, even if the parents don't want to provide aid or help to the children in paying for that education.
When you say veterans, they'd be active duty? Or?
Yes, and well, actually, if they're active duty, a lot of times there are programs the government has where you can get that paid for anyway. So that's an even better result, and you see the commercials for that. Well, that's one of the sales pitches that the military makes on TV. If you instead of going right into school, you come into the Army for 2 years, and they'll help you save $25,000 for college and give you all kinds of educational benefits on top of that. So that's another way of funding. Just deferring the college a little bit and funding, and then also you could argue that for several people that's probably a good thing because that helps them develop skill sets that could be useful. And not everybody's ready to go to college right out of high school either. So the norm is you at age 18 when you graduate from high school you go off to college, but that's not true for everybody. So some people might be better served by taking that couple years off, doing something like that, or if it's not military, maybe even looking at private employment. Because private employers provide educational benefits as well. And we'll talk about educational reimbursement plans a little bit later tonight. So that could be another way of funding education. If you happen to have your own, one of the themes you'll see develop as we go through these series of courses, hopefully you'll understand this by the time we finish, is that you need to be your own a business owner. You don't want to be just an employee. If you're an employee, basically your options are limited when it comes to financial planning and structuring your own financial affairs. If you're a business owner, you have a lot of things that can open up, and some of those things can provide educational funding opportunities for your children as well. So lots of opportunities available there. Okay? I'm sorry?
Yeah, like an employer sponsored plan.
Exactly. He mentioned an employer-sponsored plan.
If you live in Virginia, you can basically, let's say you were to go into a 529 plan now, you'd have to pay a upfront load or a load of some sort because the state-sponsored plans through American funds. Well, if you set it up through a company, they waive that load and it's completely gone.
Right. Or you could even set up things like educational reimbursement plans. As long as they're set up on a non-discriminatory basis, you can essentially pay for college costs with pre-tax income, which is even better. I have a colleague that did that. He was in the insurance side of the financial planning industry, and his daughter was kind of a natural to succeed him in this. She just had the right personality to deal with that side of the business and so on. So what he did when she was in high school is he got a license to sell insurance. He got all the licenses for securities and all of that. She had all of that coming out of high school. And then he hired her in his firm out of high school and set up an educational reimbursement plan in the firm and could pay for the first $5,250 of her education costs on a pre-tax basis, fully deductible and not included by her in her income. Beautiful thing. So you can do those kinds of things when you have the flexibility to run your own business and set up these types of arrangements. Right? Neat stuff. And when we talk about education funding, there are tons of opportunities because this is one of those areas where there's a lot of social good that gets achieved because of education. We want people to go to school. We want them to improve themselves. We want them to get advanced degrees because what does that do? From a cynical standpoint, what would attaining higher educational certifications, degrees, professional certifications, and so on do? It creates more income, and if it creates more income, that makes Uncle Sam happy because he can take more of it from you, right? He pushes you into higher tax brackets. So in a sense, and you'll see this when you get to income tax planning, there are some basic, very fundamental principles that underlie the income tax law. I know income tax law doesn't sound like that. Usually you think of it as just a bunch of rules that are slapped together, but there really are some fundamental principles. One of them is that in order to get a deduction for something, you have to be first included in income, or it has to be something that would generate income subject to tax. Well, the reason we get so many tax benefits in education is because that's going to generate future income that's subject to tax. So that's a good societal investment because long run, that'll increase tax revenues going forward. And it sounds cynical, but there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Okay, so anyway, that's the FAFSA and what you would do, and you can reduce that contribution, but it's difficult if you're a higher income person. Any questions on that process? Usually, you're not going to. In most financial planning situations, you'll have clients that'll have to fill out the FAFSAs, and who might qualify for some loans and might qualify for things like work study programs and so on. But for the most part, you're probably in the planning process going to want to focus on creating family resources to pay for a majority of these costs. Now, there are also financial aid programs available at the federal level and at the state level. In this course, we're only going to look at the federal programs because that's what gets tested on something like a CFP exam. In your state, there may also be programs available. So you should, wherever you're practicing, you want to make sure you know the rules there because you may be able to provide some additional benefit and value to your customers by directing them there. But there are different types of grants and loans that are available. The first one is a Pell Grant. And when you hear the word grant, that means it's a gift. It's just a transfer of money. If the expected family contribution is very, very small, meaning that we have a family with limited financial resources, but we have a student that with a lot of potential and we want to encourage them to go to school, the government may give them a federal Pell Grant, and this doesn't require repayment. This is only available for undergraduate students. The amount is determined based on that expected family contribution. And the amount that's available for the Pell Grants varies from year to year. Congress funds that from year to year. It's not a fixed amount or some magic number that we try to hit. It goes up and down over time. So that's a Pell Grant. That's just a direct payment, if you will, a part of the tuition costs. Now, unless you have a family that has very low income, you're probably not going to see these. What you're more likely to see are these Stafford loans. And Stafford loans are exactly what they sound like. They're loans. They allow you to borrow money to pay for educational costs. And these come in a few different forms. We have direct loans and then family federal education loans. The direct loans come from funds directly from Uncle Sam. So this comes out of Uncle Sam's coffers. He loans you the money. The family federal education loans come from private source. So the funding source is a little bit different. In order to qualify for these, you have to be an undergraduate student. For the Stafford loans, at least, you have to be an undergraduate student. There are other loans available for graduate students, and you have to be at least a half-time student. So whatever the normal load is, you have to take at least half of that. And there are two types of loans. There are subsidized and then unsubsidized Stafford loans. The subsidized ones are the ones you hope to get, because when you get those, you get the money, and you don't have to pay any interest on that until six months after the child graduates from college. There's no interest at all. The government pays the interest on those loans. So there's no interest accruing. It's not just a deferred interest amount. It's no interest for the term of college plus the next 6 months. Now, the availability of these is going to be based on, again, on your expected family contribution and the financial resources that are available to the family. But once 6 months after graduation comes along, then the interest starts to accrue and you have to start usually paying the interest plus start to amortize that loan down. Now, you can get certain types of deferments for these. If for example, a lot of students are experiencing this now because the economy's been so bad. Many of them, if you look at unemployment rates across the country, they look bad. Right? We're at, 9.5% or something like that across the country. If you look at unemployment rates for recent college graduates, they're probably closer to about 30%. Because the economy's been so bad, people aren't leaving work, they're not retiring, they're afraid to shift jobs because they don't want to move to another job and get laid off and be stuck without an income. So there's a lot less movement of people in and out of positions, so there's a lot less opportunity for those students, and we see this with our undergraduate students. They a lot of them are having a hard time finding those positions. So if they can't find a job, they can get deferments. If they go to graduate school, they can get deferments. That's another common thing that they'll do. And applications for graduate school, by the way, education is a counter-cyclical industry. Georgetown loves the economic slowdown because when things slow down and people don't have work to do, what do? They go back to school and ramp up their skill set so that when things start moving again, they have more value to offer and they can make more money, right? Makes sense. So there's more competition for graduate enrollment. So if you apply for graduate school and go to graduate school, you can defer that loan until after you finish graduate school, 6 months after that. So there are ways to get out of it. Now, when you get these loans, there's an administrative fee, 4% off the top. So they just take 4% off the top. That covers the cost of issuing the loan itself. But you're paying interest on the full amount. So if you take a $10,000 loan, for example, you're only going to get $9,600, 4% off the top. I think that's $400, if my mind is working right. So $400 fee for the loan, but if it's a non-subsidized loan, you're going to be paying interest on $10,000, not the $9,600 that you receive. So there are some costs associated with issuing these loans. They're not for free. We have to find a way to fund or underwrite the issuance of them, and we do that through the fees and the interest rates. The interest rates, by the way, are favorable on these. They run from 6 to about 8.5%.
I don't know
all the details of that. The colleges, in addition to providing the colleges administer these types of programs, but then on top of that, sometimes they offer private financial aid as well. So the Stafford loans that are issued may not be the total of the loans that are issued by that university. So I don't know whether Strayer was issuing private loans to people to allow them to fund their education. That could explain the difference. What we're talking about here are just the federal level programs. Okay, so that's the Stafford loan. The PLUS loans are the parents' loans. P for parent. That's the parent loans for undergraduate students. In order to get these, you have to have an undergraduate student who's at least half-time. And if there's no adverse credit history, you're entitled to get a loan equal to the cost of tuition, less the other financial aid available, less the expected family contribution. So that's the maximum amount of loan you can get. You take the tuition minus the expected family contribution minus the other financial aid you get, and that should be all you have left to pay for college, right? So here we're not asking the students to take out the obligation. Here these are the parents' obligation. So the interest rate on these are a little higher than the student loans. The student loans usually run about 6 to 8%. These run at 8.5%. It's a fixed interest rate, but they do have a 4% administrative fee, just like the other loans do. So if you're taking out a large loan, or you're going to take out large amounts over time, that 4% fee can add up. If you have equity in your home, you mentioned that earlier, it might be better to use the equity in the home and avoid this 4% fee, and especially in this interest rate environment, avoid an 8.5% interest rate, get the lower home equity rate to fund the education costs. And you do have a secured note in that case, but that's okay. You're probably expecting to pay it back anyway. Now, when the parents have the obligation to pay the loan, the parents get to deduct the interest on the loan. The kids don't. When the kids have the obligation to pay the loan, the kids get to deduct the interest costs on the loan, the parents don't. And this is a common area of confusion. We'll talk about this again when we get to income tax. A lot of people think that whoever pays the interest on the note gets to deduct it. So a lot of times you'll see parents who will have the kids take out the Stafford type loans, and then when the kids graduate, the parents will pay back the loans. They use that as a way of financing what they want to help the kids. So they'll pay back the loans, and they'll want to deduct the interest charges on those loans. You can't do it because the parents are not obligated to pay that loan back. The children are. Only the person obligated on the note is entitled to receive an income tax deduction for that interest that's paid. So that's one thing to keep in mind when you're planning as well. And quite frankly, for most of your clients, it won't matter anyway because they'll all be over I shouldn't say all, but many of them will be over the income threshold where they won't be able to deduct the interest on student loans anyway. But if you have some clients that are in that moderate income category and could deduct it, that can become an important issue.
What's the threshold?
It's an indexed amount, but it's relatively modest, and for single individuals, it's something like $70,000, and for married couples, it's somewhere around $100,000, $110,000. I don't know the exact amounts off the top of my head, but as you can see, if you're married, husband and wife, and together you make more than $110,000, say, you're not able to deduct the interest on the student loans anymore. So it's for the moderate to lower income groups. Those incentives are there to help that group of people. They're not there to help the rich people that make more than $110,000 a year. So, yeah, a different perspective on rich, right? But remember, when Congress is looking at income, they're looking at average income across the country. And I think it was the 2009 census numbers, median income in the United States, for a family of four, two-wage earner, $53,000. Two-wage earner, family of four. So much different perspective than what you and I have out here on the East Coast living in the cities, where $50,000 might be your biweekly paycheck, right? That's a little bit different, a little bit different perspective than the average American.
I believe the slide is incorrect on 8.5%, though. I think the new change is that it's 8.5% is the maximum cap.
Okay. That is the cap. I know that's
the cap. That's the cap now, because it was a variable interest rate, and they run anywhere from over the last 15 years from 4% to 12.5.
Yeah, they may vary it a little bit. Yeah. Okay, and then consolidation loans, last one. These are where you can consolidate all these education loans together. Sometimes if you have multiple loans outstanding and interest rates go down, it may make sense to refinance those at a lower rate. So you're paying less debt service and allocating more to principal reduction. So that's what the consolidation loans will do if you decide to do that. One of the potential problems with the consolidation loan, though, is that you won't be, once you move outside of the Stafford type loans, you won't be able to get deferments if you do a consolidation type loan. So if you're not working or you meet other conditions that would qualify for a deferment, you're still going to have to make the payments on those consolidated loans. So that sometimes prevents people from doing that. Okay, and then the campus based aid, these are programs that are federally funded but are administered by college campuses across the country. There are three primary ways that students can get additional funding. One is the Federal Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant, and this is just like the Pell Grant. It's a gift for people that don't have the money to pay the full tuition. They can get the Pell Grants, they could get the Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant as well, as long as they're an undergraduate, full-time, or part-time student. These are based on need, so this all goes back to that FAFSA and the expected family contribution that's determined based on the information reported on the FAFSA. There are also work programs, federal work-study programs. These actually can be very valuable for students, even ones that don't necessarily need to get the funding. But obviously they need to have a financial need in order to qualify for this. But the work-study programs allow students to work on campus and get paid for working on campus while they're pursuing their undergraduate education. And they can use that money to help subsidize the education costs. Oftentimes, for example, at my university, we have several work-study students. I have one that works with me, and primarily he does research-based work. So he's learning skills that he can use when he gets out in the business world. It's a business school, so he's learning a lot about the business applications and so on. So it allows the students to get experience as well as get some funding for school. Kind of a neat thing. And then the Perkins loans are for people with very low expected family contributions again. So this is again needs-based, and you're seeing the theme develop here, right? All these grant and loan programs are definitely needs-based. These can be used for undergraduate or graduate education. They have a 5% interest rate. There's no 4% administrative fee, and there's a 9-month grace period for repayment after you finish and you have 10 years to repay. So this is just another way of getting an additional amount to finance that education if you don't have the cash to do it. Okay, so those are the campus space. The state governments, as I mentioned earlier, have their own programs. Many states have similar programs, grants and loan programs, that you can take advantage of. So wherever you're practicing, make sure you know those rules. Institutional-based programs, these would be things from businesses. Many businesses set up educational reimbursement plans. So if you have perhaps a student who's working, at the undergraduate level, it's not uncommon to see a student who's working and going to school. Not common. Most people don't do that, but some people do to finance their education. And that may provide them with an opportunity to get some of that paid for directly by the employer. Armed Forces, we talked about a little bit earlier, and then certainly any private grant scholarships or fellowships that might be available could also be sources of funding. Lots of foundations and private charities provide grants for education based on interest areas. For example, the American Accounting Association might provide a scholarship for somebody interested in pursuing a degree in accounting, and it might be based on their performance at school. So there are ways to get additional money and funding to pay for those costs.
Also you have assistantships with with graduate students.
Yep.
Half work and teaching and other, and you apply for those too.
Right. You won't see those in the professional graduate programs, but for master's and PhD programs, a lot of times the students in those programs will teach. They'll teach. The master's students might teach undergraduate students, and the PhD students might teach graduate level students in return for tuition remission. So it's a way of funding the educational costs through work. And they usually get a stipend as well to pay for incidental costs. You know, they need a place to live and they need some food on occasion, right? When they're not getting the free food at the university. So
why do the financial assistance programs, why do they limited, or why do they go down if the student receives outside scholarships versus outside of school? So as an example, qualify for loans and Perkins loan, financial assistance, and then you apply to other scholarship sources outside of the school, and you still haven't received those scholarships, and then let's say you do receive a significant amount. The school will diminish their funding to you, but in some of those cases, the scholarship that's given to you is, you know, for books and computers and so forth. So
right, but you can think of it as the scholarship is increasing the expected family contribution by the amount of the scholarship. So by doing that, it reduces the financial need. So, and then since they're trying to allocate those funds on an equitable basis, that'll reduce the funding available for a particular student. So it's just like it's equivalent to having money in the bank, if you will,
right,
when you do the FAFSA. So if I get a $5,000 scholarship for my kid, that's like me having $5,000 or my child having $5,000 in his checking account that can be used to pay directly for education. It increases the family contribution.
Well, the situation applies to me when I went to graduate school, and I got a significant amount of money outside of the school,
mm-hmm.
and I was penalized for that. And I just remember thinking, here I went ahead and applied for all these scholarship sources where there was a need, and then once I received that, the school penalized me for that, and then I was actually they took the money out. So it was just interesting to see how the scholarship outside of the school was.
Well, relatively speaking, though, by receiving those scholarships, now you weren't as needy as other students were. So they wanted to reallocate those funds to the students that had the most need. That's in theory what happens. It doesn't feel that way when it happens to you, right? But in theory, that's what's going on.
Are grants always tax-free if you get it from the government?
As long as they're used to pay for tuition or related costs. You can't use them to pay for room and board. Or scholarships are tax-free as well. If you receive a private scholarship and it's used to pay directly for education, tuition costs and fees and things like that, no tax on that. But if you can use it to pay room and board expenses or buy pizza and beer on Friday nights or anything else, then that's taxable income. Or another thing, I had a client last year who got rather upset with us when she had her tax return done because she got more in scholarship money than tuition cost. And she was annoyed because she had to pay tax that year. She'd never had to pay tax before, and she owed income tax that year. Well, if you get a scholarship that exceeds the tuition costs, you're not using it to pay tuition, that's taxable income. So you've got the characteristic of the funding source is sometimes important.
What about fellowships? Anything also federal fellowships?
Yeah,
yes.
Now, usually the stipends would be taxable if you have a fellowship. Sometimes they pay for the education cost directly, but then you also get a stipend for living type expenses. Technically, the stipends are taxable, but usually most students that receive fellowships have so low income that they're probably below the poverty level anyway, and they're probably not going to trigger a large tax even if they have it. So it depends on the circumstances. Okay? Other questions? Who wants to go first?
Why are private student loans included in the list of other aid?
Well, they're available.
I mean, it's out there.
Yeah, it's out there.
Well,
it's not really aid. That's just a loan like any other loan, right? So you can go out and get a loan for anything. So yes, you could privately fund it through borrowing yourself. That's another source.
For medical students, there are certain programs for loan forgiveness.
Yes.
How do those work?
If you provide services, usually in inner city poor areas, for a period of time after you graduate, oftentimes the loans can be forgiven. That's also true for teachers. If you have students that want to become public school teachers and they spend at least 5 years serving a low-income community, usually in an urban type setting, their student loans will be forgiven. They won't have to pay them back at all.
Now, would they work there full-time? Or is
full-time.
Okay.
Yeah.
For 5 years.
Yeah, full-time, 5 years. So there's a service requirement, but you can get rid of the loans. Yeah, yeah. I don't know all the requirements, but it's based on average income for students served in that community.
And they're paid during that time?
Oh yeah, they get paid to be.
Pay their loan payments?
No.
No,
they don't have to pay the loan payments, and if they meet the service requirement, the loans are forgiven.
But how do you know when you graduate and you get a job as a teacher? How do you know that you're going to qualify?
Well, if you get a job in one of those districts,
okay,
you get a deferment. And if you defer it until you leave that job, and you've been at that job at least 5 years, then you don't have to pay it back. So that's a way to encourage, hopefully, good teachers to go into areas that need good teachers to try and bring those people out of the conditions that they find themselves in. Yes?
I have a question. Maybe a little off topic, but say for a graduate level attorney,
mm-hmm.
You have your public and your private loans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were to pass away, do you have to pay back either of those loans, the private or?
Well, the private ones you may have to pay back because those are determined based on the.
If you're married, let's say. You're
yeah,
married,
yeah.
So they take on that debt.
The government-based loans would not have to be paid back. Now you can't. It'd be nice if we could leave debt to somebody. Think about how nice that would be in my will if I could leave my debt to a specific person and force them to pay it back. That'd be a wonderful thing. So yeah, no, you can't leave debt to somebody. But when somebody dies, if there is a repayment obligation, then the estate's assets will be used to pay those loans before the beneficiaries will receive assets. Now that gets into some other planning. Because when you get to estate planning, you'll find that there are different ways that assets pass at death. We can pass them either through probate or through operation of law or by titling, by contract. But if we don't have any of the assets passing through the probate process and we don't have secured debts, many of those debts will probably be extinguished. So it just depends on how what type of debt you have and how the assets are passing to the beneficiaries. Now, having said that, remember that there are ethical issues here as well, because I could go out, I could borrow all kinds of money on an unsecured basis and then die and make sure I don't have any assets passing through my probate estate, which means all the creditors are going to get stiffed. but maybe that's not the right thing to do. Some clients may relish that thought. Other clients may feel pretty bad about that because they might feel that is just another, as a sophisticated form of theft. So you've got different perspectives on this, and you got to consider how the client's thinking about that if you're going to set it up right for the client. You know, all the good stuff comes in the end. The best course in this program is the estate planning course, because that's where you get to put it all together. And you take all of these various concepts, you put it together, and you put it all together in the capstone course, of course, but in estate planning, usually we've covered all the basic needs, education, funding, retirement planning, all that stuff's covered, and now we can do the real fun stuff, which is transferring the assets and avoiding taxes. And remember, avoiding taxes is a patriotic duty. So knowing how to do that is a necessity, as a planner anyway.
Talk a little bit about the
CERN EE bond. Yeah, I'll go through all of these. These are the tax. Any other questions on what we've covered so far before I move on? What you see in front of you, this list, are the tax-motivated savings opportunities for education. And as I mentioned, over time, if you look at federal financial aid on a inflation-adjusted basis, it's fluctuated a little bit over time, but we used to provide a little bit more than we do now. But to counterbalance that, we've provided taxpayers with an opportunity to save on a tax advantage basis for education and also take advantage of things like tax credits. So the first one on the top of the list, the qualified tuition programs or 529 plans, that's probably the most popular education savings device today. 529 plans allow you to put money in. The money can be invested. It grows, hopefully. Hopefully it'll go up in value. Maybe the last couple of years it hasn't, but maybe that'll turn around the last 10 years. So, but anyway, in theory, you put the money into the account and it grows over time. And then when you take the money out to pay for education costs, that's not a taxable event. You don't have to pay any tax on the growth. So a 529 plan, in essence, is a way of getting tax-free income, tax-free growth, to pay for education costs. Why would the government allow you to do that? Why do they want to give you the opportunity for tax-free growth there? If they forgo the opportunity to collect the tax and get you in a position where you have greater human capital and a higher skill set and are making more money, are they better off? They're tremendously better off. So there's a temporary trade-off, but a long-run benefit for the government when people do that. So that's the 529 plan. We'll talk about these in a little more detail in a second. Coverdell education savings accounts, I mentioned those already. Those can be used to pay for elementary and secondary school costs. The problem with the Coverdell accounts is you can only put $2,000 a year into them per beneficiary. So it's a very limited funding opportunity. Although if you use them right, and especially if you cascade them in an intergenerational plan, you can provide a lot of value. So I'll show you, if we have some time, I'll show you how that can be done. Not too many people will do it, but if you have those families that are looking a long way into the future, that could be a valuable technique. Roth IRAs. You don't usually think of Roth IRAs or traditional IRAs as educational funding devices. And oftentimes these are dedicated to retirement funding. And quite frankly, if you look at the typical family, probably the retirement funding is going to be more important than the education funding. The parents are going to be more concerned about making sure that they're going to have enough money to live on before they get to the point where they're going to give away large amounts of money to the children to pay for educational costs, usually. Not always. Sometimes families have a higher value placed on the educational funding need. It just depends on where the family places its value. But if we have money in the retirement account, let's say we don't have enough money initially to save for both retirement and education. So we start putting money in these IRA accounts, Roth or traditional. If you take the money out to pay educational expenses, you won't have any tax penalties applying. Now, once you hit age 59 and a half, there wouldn't be any tax penalties anyway, but if you're under age 59 and a half and you take money out of one of those accounts for anything other than the retirement or death or disability or a handful of other things, usually you have to pay income tax on that plus a 10% penalty. If you take it out to pay educational expenses, though, 10% penalty goes away. So that's a very nice benefit. There's a little bit of a difference between the traditional and the Roth, and then I'll take your question. With the traditional, everything's taxable usually, because that usually represents pre-tax income that's in that account. With the Roth IRA, you don't get a deduction for what you put in, and all the growth is tax-free. Now with a Roth, if you take money out of that Roth to fund educational expenses before you reach age 59 and a half, and the educational expenses could be for your kids. It's not only just for you, but for your dependents. But let's say you're 50 years old and your kid's going off to school. You take money out of the Roth. You will pay income tax on that distribution, because in order for the Roth distribution to be tax-free, you have to have the money in the account for 5 years, and you have to be over 59 and a half. So you have that 59 and a half rule applying there too, but there'll be no penalty. So anytime there's a distribution for educational expenses from a Roth or a traditional IRA before age 59 and a half, there will be an income tax consequence. But having said that, if we have limited funds for accumulation and our primary concern is really retirement as opposed to education funding, we can put it in the IRAs, and if the IRAs do really well, or if our income goes up at a later time and we have excess money to pay for education, we can tap into those to help fund the education needs. Okay, question?
I think you just answered it, but the only way you can pull out from the Roth to pay for qualified IRA education without the penalty is if it's you, or if it's the owner. I can't pull that to pay for my kid.
Yes, you can.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for a dependent. As long as the child is a dependent. So if the child's not a dependent for tax purposes, you couldn't do it.
So it can't be a grandkid.
No. Well, if the grandchild is a dependent,
yeah. You
could do it. But in that case, you're probably over 59 and a half, most likely. So, yeah. So you wouldn't have the 10% penalty in that case.
And does the 5 year not apply since you're pulling it out anyway? I mean, the 5 year applies if you're using it for retirement, but you're eligible for the no penalty withdrawal.
Yes. For education, that's correct. And the other benefit with Roth, since this isn't the retirement planning class, you get that toward the end. With a Roth IRA, you can always take your contributions out on a tax-free basis at any time, without tax or penalty. So whatever you put in is, if let's say for 5 years, you put in $5,000 a year, you have $25,000 of basis in the Roth IRA. The first $25,000 you take out will be completely tax-free, because that'll be considered a return of your contributions. And any amount in excess of that would be subject to income tax if you're under 59 and a half when you take it out to pay for education costs. I'm sorry?
You pay 10% of the excess?
No. Now, well, and this gets to this, right, see, everybody always wants to get to the good stuff, which is retirement and estate planning. You don't want to skip all this fundamental garbage and the income tax stuff. Nobody wants to look at that, right? But with the Roth, it depends on whether it's an IRA or a conversion. If it's a Roth IRA, you can always take the basis out tax-free without any penalty. If you took a traditional IRA, which many people are doing this year, and you convert it into a Roth IRA, and then you take a distribution of that converted amount out within a 5 year period, you will pay a 10% penalty on that. But that only applies to converted IRAs. When we go from traditional to Roth, it doesn't apply to Roth IRAs where you originally put the contributions directly into the Roth account.
When you set up the COVID, you say it's $2,000 per year,
right?
Right. So would that be $2,000 per Social Security of the student?
Well, per beneficiary. So for each child, the most that you can put in for any one person is $2,000. So I can't put in $2,000, and my wife can't put in $2,000, and my parents can't put in $2,000. It's $2,000 per child. So that's why, and you, the child has to be under age 18, so that means you can only do it for 18 years. So the most you can get in is going to be $36,000 over an 18-year period. And the benefit of the covered L is the same as the 529 plan. If you take it out to pay education costs, it's tax-free. All the growth is tax-free. But because you're dealing with a smaller amount, you're not getting as big a benefit. Now, the way you would cascade that, I mentioned that. I'll just give you the tip on this. Let's say that I have a grandchild that's born today. And I know that I'm going to be around. My family has longevity. I know I'm going to be around to pay all the education costs. So I'm going to write checks to cover all of that stuff when the kid goes to school. Nevertheless, I may want to set up a Coverdell account for that child today. Put the $2,000, now I may not be able to because of income limitations, but that's another neat thing about the Coverdells. Theoretically, if the contributor's income is too high, you can't make the contribution. But that's easy. You just find a poor friend or relative. Find somebody who has income below that limit. You give them the $2,000, and then they make the contribution for the kid. So you can get around that very easily and fund it. Now, we put the $2,000 a year in for the 18 years. It doesn't accumulate to an awful lot because it's a small amount of money. But instead of using it for that child, one of the things we can do with a Coverdell is we can name another beneficiary of that account. In fact, by the time the child reaches age 30, we have to, or we have to pay the amount out of the Coverdell account. So let's say by the time that my grandchild is 30, he's gotten married and has a child. What we would do is we would take all the money in that Coverdell for him, roll it into the account for my great-grandchild, continue to put $2,000 a year in for another 18 years. And now, because we have a 36-year window, whenever we have a long-term window, time value takes over. And now we can take these tiny little bits of money and turn them into great big piles of money. Right, so that's an intergenerational cascade on a Coverdell education savings account. Yes, and if we want to for the great-grandchild, we could pay for the prep school or wherever we want to send them. Yes. Yeah, or you could use it for college, right? And it all grows on a tax-free basis. So if you cascade it over a generation like that, you're getting time value to work on your side. And that's where these things can be valuable. A lot of times people look at these little tiny techniques and they say, oh, this is only a couple $1,000s. It's not worth considering, right? How much tax-free income can I earn on $2,000 this year, particularly if I'm investing it somewhat conservatively? Not a heck of a lot. But how much tax-free income can I earn on $2,000 over a 40-year period, compounded annually? A lot more. So the time value is really key.
Two kids and one of them got a full ride scholarship. Can you open those accounts for both of them? Can you apply?
Yeah, you could roll it to the other.
The other kid.
Absolutely, absolutely, or roll it to their kids or whoever in the family needs it.
Okay.
That's one of the benefits. And you can do the same thing with the 529 plan as well. You can roll it to other. I'm sorry. Well, not a Coverdell, because to make a contribution, the person, the beneficiary, has to be under age 18.
Oh, that's right.
So hopefully your wife isn't under age 18, right? So I maybe in some states that's allowed, but I don't think it's allowed here. So.
And it has to be a relative?
Usually, it's got to be somewhat related.
So what happens in today's society with blended families? Let's say you get married.
Mm-hmm. Stepchild? You probably can. I'd have to double check it, but my guess is yes, you could. Okay?
Two questions.
Oh, okay. No. Well, I got you first last time, so I'll go to her first this time.
So. Educational IRAs, I've always assumed.
That's the Coverdell.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then my second question is, you can transfer from a Coverdell savings account to a 529, but not the opposite one.
Yes.
Correct? Okay.
Yes.
So clients who are within the income limitations and they perhaps want to pay for their children to go to private school,
mm-hmm.
You should fund that first.
Fund the Coverdell first,
okay.
And then if you have excess funding, put it in the 529. The Coverdells used to be called, for the first 4 or 5 years they were around, they were referred to as education IRAs, which itself is a misnomer, right? Education Individual Retirement Account?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense at all. But
that's
yeah, and now the latest thing is to name tax code provisions after various congressmen and senators. They're all rushing to get their name on something. So now we call it a Coverdell education savings account. So, okay.
When the tax credits expire at the end of the year, does the amount you put into a Coverdell decrease?
No, because that was available before the 2001 tax legislation. That was passed as part of the 1997 Act. Taxpayer Relief Act of 97 created Coverdells. So that will not expire.
So I understand that Cloverdale would be a beneficiary. You can have more than one beneficiary on one Cloverdale,
I don't believe so. I think you have to have only one beneficiary, but you can always roll the account to another beneficiary.
Right. So if you had two grandchildren, you couldn't like throw $4,000 into the same account.
No.
That's basically my question.
No, you'd have to have two separate accounts.
Two separate accounts and then maintain it, but then I can always roll them over.
Then you could roll one into the other. Yeah, one of them goes off to a military academy, doesn't have to pay for school. The other needs the money. We roll it into that account and use the money to pay for school.
Would you be losing your, you know, I know it's not much, but you'll be drawing against your exemption for $2,000 if you transferred to somebody else, which, you know, like the wealthy family in that scenario, they just gave it to somebody else because they're not able to qualify for the Coverdell. They gave that money to somebody else who would then contribute to it, but you're using their exemption.
Okay, everybody hear that? Question was, with the Coverdell, on the technique I suggested where if your income's too high, you want to fund it, you give some money to someone else, and then later on they decide to contribute it to the Coverdell account. Well, if every year you have the right to give $13,000 a year to whoever you want on a tax-free basis. So as long as I give that money to a person who I wouldn't have otherwise given the money to, I'm not really using anything up. And then you have to have the transaction be old and cold to make it work. I can't have a direct transfer. But if I give them some money and then 4 months later they decide to drop it into the Coverdell account where they had the opportunity to exercise dominion and control over that money, then you've broken up the transaction, and I think that's legitimate. So. Yeah, there might be. That's unclear. But it's a small amount anyway, so it should. We're not dealing with hundreds of thousands of dollars usually, unless you did really well on the investments. But usually it's a small amount. Okay.
Once the beneficiary starts taking a distribution, they don't use the amount in the account.
Oh, for education. Oh, yeah. So let's say I have more in the account than I need to pay for child one's education. Whatever's left, I could roll into the account for child two. Sure. Absolutely. Okay? So Coverdells are useful. And by the way, Coverdells give you investment flexibility, too, whereas 529 plans don't give you direct investment flexibility. A lot of the 529 plans are managed accounts. The Coverdell, you can go to Vanguard or Fidelity, and you can buy individual mutual funds, whatever ones you want. So some people use it for that purpose as well because they have more control, more direct control over the investments. So that's helpful. Okay, now we also have some credits, tax credits that are available. The American Opportunity Credit, the credit formerly known as the HOPE credit, right? That's the new name for this. The American Opportunity Credit is the most popular tax credit. It gives us the biggest benefit for the smallest expenditure. And I'll go through the details of that in a second. It only applies, though, for the first 4 years of post-secondary education. So it only applies basically for your undergraduate program. Once you go beyond undergraduate, then the lifetime learning credit is available. And this is available to anybody at any age. And you don't even have to be a full-time student. You could go take a class in basket weaving at the local community college if you want to and get a tax credit for it, provided that your income falls within specified limits. Now, having said that, most of your clients are not going to qualify for either one of these credits because their income is going to be too high. But if you have moderate to lower income clients that are trying to fund their kids' education, then these are extremely valuable tools. So for that moderate, middle, kind of that middle America group, very, very valuable tools. Series EE bonds, I'll cover the details of this in a second. Essentially with an EE bond, as long as you buy them, as long as an adult purchases them after age 24, and they're cashed in to pay for educational costs, the interest on those bonds becomes tax-free. So you don't have to pay income tax on the interest, and that's a benefit, but think about, and I know you haven't been through the investments class, but I know you know the answer to this anyway. Would it make sense for me to buy a bunch of Series E bonds to fund my kid, my newborn child's college education?
No.
Why not? That's one of the worst things you can do. Why? Because first of all, you're going to get an interest rate that is not going to keep up with taxes and inflation. On a real basis, you're losing money. And secondly, as over a long period of time, incomes tend to go up, which means you may not qualify for the income tax exemption anyway. And if you have time on your side, if you have an 18-year investment planning horizon, what kind of investments should we be putting that money into? Growth. Because we have the time to withstand those market cycles, right? So we'd be much better off. We'd have a much better terminal accumulation if we invested that in growth securities, even if we had to pay some tax, than we'd have if we invested in the Series EE bonds. Now, having said that, if you have people that have the EE bonds and meet the qualifications, you might as well take advantage of it, right? But I wouldn't plan for using these as an educational funding tool. We can use the Uniform Gifts to Minors Act transfers as well. This is where you give your kids money. But you got to watch out here. If you give your kids money, what does that do?
It's theirs.
Well, first of all, it's theirs. So if it's a pure UGMA or UPMA type transfer, as soon as they hit their 18th birthday, what can they do? They can clean out the account and use it for whatever they want. They don't have to use it for education. And you can't take it back unless you're willing to commit larceny, unless you're willing to steal it from your child. You can't take it back. They could actually bring criminal charges against you. Now, luckily, none of them know this, because I know a lot of people that do this. I don't think my kid's responsible enough, so I'm going to take that $40,000 back, and I'll hold it until they go to school. Well, you just stole the money from the kid. They could file criminal charges for that. So you got to be real careful in how you do this. And if you're going to transfer money to the children, in other classes we'll talk about other tools to use that'll give you more control over the ultimate use of that money. And that's always good when we're dealing with younger people, because most younger people don't know how to handle money unless they've been trained from a very young age, and most people don't fit that classification. We can deduct interest on educational loans, the interest on student loans if you meet certain income requirements, and then we also have these employer educational assistance programs, which I've alluded to as well. Now, the qualified state tuition plans are 529 plans. We already covered the basics. They're tax deferred growth. If you take the money out to pay for educational costs, it becomes tax free. So it's a way of generating tax free income. And the usually have low commissions, and if you put money in these accounts, you can still control the assets, but keep the assets out of your estate. Now this is something that you'll learn more about when you get to your last substantive course, the estate planning course. But usually, if I transfer money to somebody, or I transfer money into an arrangement for someone else's benefit, but I still control the arrangement, when I die, I'm still going to be subject to tax on the value of that fund. With a 529 plan, I can transfer the money, completely control it, and keep it out of my estate, not have to worry about paying estate taxes on it. So that's one of the benefits of a 529 plan versus other types of tools. Now, 529 plans, I just want to mention this as well in passing. The popular conception of these is that this is what everybody should use. If you read the financial press, you read the magazines and so on, everybody should have a 529 plan. And whenever you see somebody saying everybody should do something, you know that they don't know what they're talking about. Because there's no such thing as the right answer for everybody. That doesn't exist when you're doing good planning. You have to match the planning to the circumstances of the client. Now, the people that are not going to want to use the 529 plans, and this may seem counterintuitive at first, but I want to spend just a few minutes going over this to make sure everybody gets this. The people that don't want to use these are your high income, high net worth people. We don't want to use a 529 plan. Anybody know why? You would think that being high income, getting tax-free growth, would be a more valuable thing than the lower income people, right?
State, though, isn't it? In that sense.
Well, in order to fund a 529 plan, and this is a little subtle, but it's important to see this. To fund a 529 plan, I have to use what you were talking about before, my annual exclusion. to put the money in, $13,000. So when I, let's say I have a child born today, I want to put money in a 529 plan. I could actually gross it up by five. I could do five annual exclusion gifts all at once and put it into the plan. Now the problem with that is if I give the money to the 529 plan, I can't give other assets to that child for those years. So I have a huge opportunity cost from a wealth transfer perspective. Now what would be a lot better, what would be more optimal for high net worth people would be not to use a 529 plan, to write the check when junior goes off to college, right? Take out your checkbook, write the check. That's a qualified transfer. It's not considered a gift. It's immediately outside of your estate. It's a direct transfer. And it doesn't use your annual exclusion, any of your lifetime exemption, or anything else for estate planning purposes or gift planning purposes. And give the kid every year $13,000 in a trust. If I take $13,000 and put it in a trust for the benefit of the child every year for 18 years and accumulate that at, say, 8% or 9%, the kid's going to have $500,000 or so sitting there at age 18 that they wouldn't have if I used that money to fund the 529 plan.
What would that trust be
titled? Well, usually it wouldn't be an education. Usually it's some kind of crummy trust, and that's a term of art, but it's a trust that allows us to use the annual exclusion but still control the assets to a certain extent. We can put conditions on the ultimate disposition of those assets. So you'll learn more about this in estate tax, but using the annual, essentially with a 529 plan, I have to use my annual exclusion for something that I don't have to use an annual exclusion for to fund. If I pay the education cost directly, I don't use my annual exclusion for gift tax purposes. If I pay the education cost through a 529 plan, I have to use my annual exclusion. And the opportunity cost of that is significant for high net worth people. It's much better to transfer the assets directly to the kids and pay for the costs of education directly.
Is there a maximum age for an individual to set up a 529?
No. No, you could set one up right now for yourself. Yeah, you could do that, or let's say, I don't know, you're thinking about doing a PhD in astrophysics or something down the road when you retire. You could set up a 529 plan and fund it now, put a little money in, grow it on a tax-free basis, and when you get to retirement and you go off to school, you could use it to pay for that. So a 529 plan doesn't have to terminate at any age. You can keep that throughout your lifetime. You can fund lifetime education costs.
So if you're about to die and you want to skip, you know, send some money, you know, to kids who are, you know, under 18, mm-hmm. you know, going to go to school? Does it pay to throw a five-year version into,
no,
you know, 529?
No, it doesn't. Did everybody hear that? If you're about to die, should you fund 529 plans for all of your family members? The answer is no, because you can put five times the annual exclusion in, but if you die within the five-year period, they bring it back into your estate and subject it to estate tax. The better way to do it would be to take out the checkbook and write checks for all the tuition costs. So if you have 10 kids going to Harvard at $60,000 a year, write a check for $600,000 to Harvard 5 minutes before you die. If you do that, that's not a gift. There's no gift tax consequence, and you've just saved about $300,000 in estate taxes by writing that check 5 minutes before you die, as opposed to waiting until after you die to make the transfer. So why give it to the government when you don't have to, right? You should never give more than you have to the government. Taxes are forced extractions. They're not.
Would you recommend, say somebody's like a net worth, obviously not over like the $7 million now. You have like somebody in the middle of the ground, like $3, $4 million.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, it may very well grow like to the 5 or 6.
Yep.
So what would you, in that scenario, what would you do for that person?
Well, part of it depends on the perspective of the client, and you'll see this, you'll get my perspective on this as you go through, because you'll have me for a few of these courses, and you'll get Mike's perspective on this too, and most of the time we agree on this, but it doesn't matter what the net worth of the client is. What matters is their perspective. I can take somebody with a very low net worth and who has the right, what I would call the right perspective on setting up their financial plan. And what we can do is we can manage their situation so that we achieve all those financial objectives outside of the tax system. by structuring things the right way to begin with. What most people do, unfortunately, what we do in this country is, well, in this country, what everybody does, and this is human nature. What are you told to do? You're told to after you get out of school, what do? You go out, you make a lot of money. You make a ton of money, create this huge pile of stuff. And then once you have this huge pile of stuff, what do we have to do then? We have to protect that huge pile of stuff. We have to find ways to exempt it from tax. And we have to find ways to make sure that nobody else can get a hold of it. Well, a better way of planning would be, instead of creating the huge pile of stuff and then trying to do the planning after the fact, the better way of planning would be to create all the wealth in vehicles that are going to protect the assets to begin with and are not going to be subject to tax. Because then I never have to worry about paying the tax. So the lower net worth people with the right perspective might be doing what I would call better planning than that client that has $4 or $5 million, kind of a moderate net worth, but is the control freak and can't stand the thought of putting $10,000 in the kid's name because that's $10,000 less than they have on their balance sheet. Right? People do tend to be control freaks. That's human nature. And new money people in particular are control freaks. So unless people have seen this process occur and understand how it works, usually it's difficult to get them to a point where they can create it in alternate vehicles. You see, the best estate plan, and this is going to sound completely counterintuitive, best estate plan would be never to own anything. I don't want to own a thing. I don't want to show up on the Forbes 400 list. You'll never see my name on the Forbes 400 list, even if I wound up having that kind of money. It won't be on the Forbes 400 list, because if I'm going to accumulate it, I'm going to accumulate it outside of my name in other vehicles where it can't be touched. And then it protects that value for the family. Much different perspective. That's usually what...
Forbes recently. There was a magazine, I think, that actually said that, I feel like, recently, where I read that.
Yeah. Most of the people on the Forbes, they just released this within the last month, that Forbes list of billionaires. Most of the people on that list are new money people. You don't see a lot of old money people on that list, maybe second generation wealth, but almost all of them is self-made wealth. The real wealth, which is many times more than what you see on those types of lists, nobody knows. The only people that know are the people that are involved in the planning and the people that own the assets. Because they're structured so that nobody can get a hold of them. Beautiful thing. Wonderful thing. So hopefully that'll change your perspective a little bit on the planning. So to get back to your original question, don't look at the asset value when you're deciding whether or not to do a planning or use a planning approach with a client. What you want to look at is what their perspective is, and if they're thinking about it from a longer term perspective, we might be able to do things with them that we can't do with other people. All right? Questions? Okay, so those are the 529 plans. 529 plans aren't the right answer for everybody, and there's no such thing as the right answer for all people. That's the Susie Orman approach to planning. If it was that simple, you wouldn't be here. Right? You could just tell everybody to do the same thing, and that'd be the end of it.
For
the middle class, the kind of the moderate to lower income groups, many times they are higher income but low net worth. See, the ideal client is high net worth, low income. That's the ideal client. We don't want to have a high income because we have to pay tax on income, but we want a high net worth so we can enjoy the fruits of life, right? So a little bit different perspective, but the typical middle tier person has high income, very low net worth, and using a 529 plan and growing those assets on a tax-free basis will provide a big benefit for them, because chances are they're not using wealth transfer or shifting devices anyway. So if they're not already giving the money away to the kids, it doesn't hurt to use the 529. It just gives them tax-free income. If they're already giving money to the kids, if they're already shifting the wealth, then the 529 plan becomes more of a hindrance than a help.
How would you pick 529 over Coverdell if somebody does
that? Well, I do both.
You can have both, right?
Sure, you can have both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can do both if you want to. Yep. No, I'd do both in the right circumstances. Okay. Any other questions? Does that answer? Okay. The prepaid tuition plans are versions of 529 plans. These are usually sponsored by the states. Usually for state schools, you can buy prepaid tuition credits. You can actually prepay the tuition for the kids. So every year you could buy a semester's worth of credits for junior. And when junior gets to be age 18, junior goes off to state university, everything's covered. And the advantage of these types of plans usually is you're paying at today's rates. And you buy the credits, so no matter what happens from the cost perspective, you're covered. If the child doesn't go to that college, sometimes these plans allow you to take a cash value, if you will, and apply that at another school. Other times it locks you in to the college. So you got to be careful about these things and make sure that you're not going to be putting money into something that the child isn't going to use. So if the child might not attend, then we've got a problem. Okay, so that's not as popular anymore. The 529 plans are more popular. The college savings plans, let's just skip over. I want to get to here's the Coverdell. Let's spend a few minutes just going over the requirements for Coverdell. We've covered most of this. $2,000 limit, beneficiary under age 18, and then the AGI limits apply, and they're relatively modest. They're, I think, for married filing jointly, it completely phases out at something like $120,000 or $130,000 of income. So relatively modest AGI limits. The distributions are tax-free. There's a 10% penalty plus tax if you use it for any other purpose. Same thing with the 529 plans. And you have to distribute by age 30, but we can roll it over to another beneficiary. And we already talked about the use of these for...
Can be used by professional schools also?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've had it on the first try, was it on that one? Okay.
Yeah, you can use that for professional... it doesn't have to be a degree program.
Are we going to have to know the AGI numbers for the exam?
No, you should know roughly where they are, and we'll cover those in the income tax class. If you have a sense of where they are, usually that's enough, because if you have somebody making $250,000, obviously they're not going to qualify. If they're making 50, they will. So usually they're not going to test you on that. And those things change every year. They're adjusted for inflation. So making you memorize that is worthless. So, okay. The traditional Roth IRAs, we remember the maximum contribution for IRAs. You probably already know that from your own planning, $5,000 maximum contribution. If you're over age 50, you can put in an additional $1,000. There are AGI limits that apply to both of these. With the traditional, if you want to take a tax deduction, there's an AGI limit that applies. If you're over that AGI limit, you can always make a non-deductible contribution to the IRA. So in that respect, a traditional IRA doesn't have an AGI limit as long as you're not taking a tax deduction for the contribution. For Roth IRAs, there is a limitation on income. So I believe for single individuals this year, it's 115 or something like that, 115, 116. But there's a range. If you make above that range, you can't make a contribution to a Roth IRA beginning this year. Now, luckily, we have a change in law this year that lets us get around that. So let's say that I'm a single individual and I make $200,000. And I want to make a Roth IRA contribution, but I can't because I'm over the limit. Well, what can I do? I can take my $5,000, I can put it into traditional IRA, and 5 seconds later, I can convert the traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. I get the money into the Roth without regard to the income limitation. So it's easy to do. There's a limit on that. If you have an existing traditional accumulation, you may be triggering another taxable event. So let's say I have $50,000 or $45,000 in a traditional IRA, and I put another $5,000 in, bringing it up to $50,000, and then I convert $5,000. My basis is $5,000, but I'm going to trigger a $4,500 taxable event on conversion, because I have to prorate the basis between the Roth IRA and the traditional, even though I'm converting this year's transfer. We'll talk more about that when we get to retirement planning, but it's possible in some cases you could be triggering a second taxable event almost phantom income, if you want to think of it that way.
There's no way to get around
No, no, it's 5,000 total between the two. So you can put it all in one, all in the other, or split it up if you qualify to make contributions to both. But the maximum amount for any IRA is 5,000 plus the $1,000 catch up. So
you gotta have the shell for the IRA in order to open a Roth.
Right. Well, if your AGI is below the limit, you can just open directly a Roth IRA. But if your AGI is above the limit, you'd open a traditional, put the money in, and then you just convert it to a Roth.
You do traditional or a 401k?
Yes. Yeah, you won't be able to deduct it probably because you're an active participant in the 401k, plus your income's probably above the deductibility phase out, so you won't get a tax deduction for the contribution to the traditional, but you can make a contribution. And then once you make the contribution, if you want to, you can turn it into a Roth.
So it's going to be tax-deductible.
Right. So the conversion won't trigger a taxable event in that circumstance. That's right. Okay? So that's the traditional and Roth IRA. This might be a good place. I just recognize the time. This might be a good place to take a break. I've been talking for a while on a Friday afternoon. So let's take a 5 or 10 minute break, and we'll come back and wrap this up and get out of here. Come back tomorrow morning and talk about time value.
Yeah.